I regard myself as a soldier, though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day
a soldier of peace,
this nation will rise up,
a soldier of peace,
live out the true meaning of its creed. We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal. I have a dream,
though a soldier of peace.
I have a dream that one day every valley shall be exalted. Every hill and mountain shall be made low, the rough places will be made plain, and the crooked places will be made straight, and the glory of the Lord shall be revealed, and all flesh shall see it.
Nonviolence Radio, covering the beat of nonviolence worldwide, from the Meta Center for Nonviolence in Petaluma, California. Welcome, everybody, to another episode of Nonviolence Radio. I'm your host, Stephanie Van Hook, and I'm here in the studio of our mother station, KWMR, with Michael Negler, my co-host and news anchor. There's common myths surrounding the practice of nonviolence and the use of nonviolence in the world. And one of those myths is actually that you don't need to be trained to practice nonviolence, that it's spontaneous, it comes up through you. It could be nonviolent response. It could be a violent response. And what we found is that nonviolence actually requires a lot of training, because we've been so conditioned toward a violent response that we don't know how nonviolence works or what it looks like. And then how can we, when we're in a fight or flight situation where we're really scared, draw upon all of these different tools in the nonviolence toolkit? So this show is going to be exploring the power of nonviolence training as related specifically to something that's called bystander intervention. Bystander intervention, why is it important? Because when we see acts of violence happening around us, and it doesn't necessarily have to be physical violence, it could be somebody being discriminated against, it could be somebody being yelled at, what we need to do is to learn how to get out of our fear state or our sense of wanting to run away from the situation and find our words and find the sense of security within us to be able to intervene and feel secure enough to do that, knowing that we have tools to help to de-escalate that situation. And it's very, very possible.
I wanted to add, Stephanie, that if only those three brave men who were on that commute train in Portland had some bystander intervention training, it's possible that they would have been alive and uninjured today.
That's one of the points of the show, is that many people do get involved in what would be considered bystander intervention without the skills and without the training, and things do happen. But then again, what we do also understand in nonviolence is that using nonviolence and intervening is also no guarantee that somebody won't get hurt, especially yourself. But what we're choosing to do is to allow ourselves to get in the way to protect somebody else from that harm. So that's another thing to discuss and something to keep in mind. Now, last Wednesday at the Meta Center office in Petaluma, we were graced with a visit by Mary Hanna, a trainer and peace team member from a wonderful organization out of Michigan called the Meta Peace Team. That's Meta with one T, Peace Team. Look them up on the web, find out about their work and their trainings. I had a week's notice to get a group of people together because she said, if you want to start a peace team in Petaluma, I'm happy to train people up. Normally, their trainings are about 8 hours long. You go through a series of different role plays and practice, and you learn these tools of how to de-escalate conflict. And then you form a team of people who then continue to work on these skills and then can be called on in situations where there could be a sense of escalating violence. And you are prepared to provide service to the community to be able to de-escalate violence on any side of the conflict. So you're not there to support one group in particular, although your heart might support that group, but you're there to just help to make violence impossible so that real dialogue and free speech can take place without harming others. So Mary trained us for about 4 hours. We did. I cut her training in half to give people just a taste of it, and then we hope to be able to invite her back. So I'm going to go ahead and share with you a little bit from Mary, and then Michael and I, throughout this segment of the show where we do the news and we do interview people who are in the field and doing this work before the news, we'll comment coming from the ideas that Mary's talking about with a little bit more sense of what's the nonviolence behind it, what is she saying, how can we better understand it, because that's our job at Meta. Okay.
Hi, I'm Mary Hanna from the Meta Peace Team. Our home office is in Lansing, Michigan, and we work based on the theory that all of us can work to end violence. We have four main pillars that support the work that we constantly do. The first pillar is educating people to the efficacy of nonviolence. Not that it's just a good idea or that it might be morally right, but that it works, that it really works. And second would be to teach people the skills of violence de-escalation. How do you get somebody to calm down or to back up or to rethink hurting somebody else? What are the skills that everyday people can use to do that? Third thing that we do is after we've got these trained people, many of them as volunteers, join peace teams, both locally within the United States and internationally, on teams of volunteers that go where invited to create a safe space for people to work out their conflict. So anything from a KKK rally to the Gaza West Bank to the U.S.-Mexico border to standing with First Nation peoples. And then lastly and not least importantly is that we network and partner with other like-minded, like-hearted, like-spirited organizations who are also working for peace with justice in this world.
So that was Mary Hanna from the Meta Peace Team talking about very clearly about what the work of a peace team, of Meta Peace Team in particular, does. And one thing that she said is that what's important in their work is helping people to understand that there's something that all of us can do in order to get involved. So, for example, which she'll go into in a little bit later in this interview, is that it doesn't matter if you are a big, strong guy who can take somebody down with your body, if that's what you have to do. Rather, on a peace team, if you are a frail person over 80, you can get involved because you can, if as long as you can drive a car, you can ride in a car and you can help to hold the phone, you can help to deliver water to people. There's lots of things that we can do. So this is really one important aspect of the work of nonviolence, is seeing that it's not a monoculture. People get involved at all different levels and that there is room for everybody.
You know, when we were building what is now called unarmed civilian peacekeeping back 20, 25 years ago, the analogy was often drawn with the military, that for every soldier in combat, I think I remember, they had about 20 people back here on the ground supporting them. You know, the administration, the supplies, the, you know, in the First and Second World War, the ladies knitting socks for the boys in the trenches. So,
yeah, now we're knitting hats for people. Now,
right, and pink hats for the women. That was a good one. I wanted to say something about the training before we go further. There was a famous episode in North India when Narayan Desai was still alive. And people asked, there was a big meeting, probably in Gujarat Vidyapeeth, that university that Gandhi founded. And they were discussing training, how long it should be. And the Americans were saying, oh, you know, I think a couple of hours would work. And more sensible people were talking about a whole weekend. And Narayan didn't say anything. And so finally they came to him and said, what do you think? And here's a man who had been with Gandhi his whole life. And he said, oh, I think one lifetime should be enough.
Oh, then that's not that much in a multiple lifetime cosmology, just one of many millions.
Sure.
That's a good point.
On the other hand, you can be trained to have certain, as you were saying, Stephanie, certain tools at your disposal. And just going into an intense situation, knowing that you have them, makes a big psychological difference.
Absolutely. And some of the things that Mary covered during the training were things that we can do in our everyday lives, like practicing not making assumptions about situations or knowing that we do make assumptions and that the more information that we get as individuals, we tend to change our minds with more information, or that we have, if we don't fully change our minds because of rational information put in there. I know that that can be a contentious point, but that human beings do have the the possibility of changing minds, and that you can be in a room of people when you are in a room of people, understanding that people in the room are seeing situations differently and they're questioning assumptions differently in that situation. So one example of an exercise that she did, very simple one, that if anybody's gone through a nonviolence training, they've probably done this, where we all went outside, all the big group of us, and she drew a line basically about 30 feet long. And on one end it was nonviolence, and the other end it was, you know, that's really a violent act. And she gave us a situation where we had to decide with limited information whether we think what's happening was nonviolent or violent. And as, you know, people are asking for more information, well, so the situation, the scenario was you walk into a restaurant and you see a couple in front of you clearly of the Islamic faith, and they ask for a table. They're told to go sit down and wait. You come in. You are not clearly wearing any signs of religious affiliation, and you find that you're seated right away. That's all the information you have. So the question is, you know, was violence involved? You know, and so people decide, they move their body and they say why. Then Mary gives a little bit more information. Well, we find out that you didn't say anything in this situation. You decided to go ahead and take your table, even though you noticed that people ahead of you weren't seated when you were. Was that violent or nonviolent? Okay, then everybody, you know, scatters around again and has a discussion, a deep discussion about that. And then finally, it comes out to that, well, actually, the couple in front of you are regulars, and there's a specific table that they always like to sit at because it's away from the music and it's away from the kitchen and it's away from the air conditioner. So it's just the right table. So this server really knows this couple and has them sit down. So then you, with more information, you see people changing their mind. And that's really the saving grace of humanity, is that we do have minds that can be, and hearts that can be changed, and to recognize that one another is giving ourselves the gift of our humanity back as well. So let's hear a little bit more about the work of Metta Peace Team. And why am I emphasizing this is because as we're getting to these ideas of bystander intervention and the importance of it, we find that peace team work is scalable work. We practice these things in our daily lives, but it can be applied to full-on, full-scale nonviolence institution that can serve in a way that to a community in a way that usually only police might be called, and the police are going to draw from violence. So it can be scaled up on that end, or it could be used when you're just sitting around, you know, Point Reyes Station, or you're sitting around Petaluma and see something happening. You have those skills as an individual. But let's hear a little bit more from Mary about what recently happened in Lansing, Michigan, to illustrate some more the really cool work that she's involved in.
One of the things that's really wonderful that John Lewis has said is that everybody has a place in the peace movement. There's room and need for everyone. And we've really witnessed that with our peace teams. We just had one last week in Lansing, Michigan. It was a supposed rally called by Act for America. Act for America is listed by the Southern Poverty Law Center as the largest anti-Muslim hate group in the United States right now, with chapters in many different states. And they said that it was going to be a rally against Sharia law in the United States and Michigan. Of course, one of the key components of this rally was that they were holding it in a very immigrant, intensely populated neighborhood. And Lansing has been very fortunate to be a community that's been very welcoming to people from all over the world. And they were going to march through the neighborhood, intimidating people. They had actually asked the Michigan militia to come armed as their personal escorts. So with 3 days' notice, we were asked by a faith community that lived in that neighborhood who had been opening their doors to immigrants, teaching them English as a second language. And we were invited by Refugee Services, and we were invited by the Islamic Center, all separate invitations asking us to please place a peace team there to help diffuse any potential violence between these protesters and the people who are just living their lives in these homes. And so in 3 days, we were able to pull together a team of 22 people who had been through our 8-hour nonviolent skills training, many of whom had already been on peace teams before, so they were kind of seasoned folk. And we stationed them around the neighborhood at key places. We had gotten information on where the march was going to begin and end, going through the neighborhood, what their route would be. And so we placed subset groups called affinity teams in the neighborhood, prepared to do protective accompaniment, helping people get to and from their cars, helping them get to and from the bus stops that were there, to and from the grocery store that was there, and do intervention, you know, physical intervention, staying between if necessary. But many of the people that have the heart to do this kind of work may not have what we would traditionally think of as the physical wherewithal. And so in this instance, we had two senior citizens. They were in their 80s. Wonderfully sharp people, but who were not physically up to walking the blocks and blocks to cover this neighborhood that traditionally peace team people often do. But what they could do, and which was imperative to doing this team, was they were in their car, and they were able to call back to us that were holding down sort of the checkpoint of sort of home base, I guess you could call it, and tell us where the marchers were, where they were heading, all by using their car. In the interim, they also delivered water to peace team people, Gatorade, protein bars, and were able to give a lift to anybody who needed to come back to home base to use the restroom or if they needed a break. It was a long, hot summer day. And by the end of that day, absolutely no violence broke out, although there were many opportunities for that to have happened. But I think that part of the beauty of a peace team is when you see people gathered to stand with the people who are being victimized and saying they're not alone, and knowing that people really care. It makes it a lot harder to target those individuals.
That was Mary Hanna again from the Meta Peace Team talking about the power of the work of a peace team and a little bit about the dynamics of what goes on when you're taking on roles in a peace team that you have. Sometimes you get invited by a group. You have 3 days to call people together to say, we're going to go into a situation where there are KKK members, there's the Michigan militia with guns and targeting a very highly populated area of immigrants. And we're going to come in and we feel confident enough that we can help to de-escalate any potential violence that could happen. So that's what's so awesome and so exciting about this work is that we can actually train. And that's the importance of training. With training, we can prepare ourselves to face down a militia with really neat tactics that we can practice in our everyday lives. But even as Mary was saying that there seems to be just sort of a common sense way about this at the end of the day, showing that you're willing to stand and make it a little bit harder to harass another person. That's one thing, but there is a real science behind nonviolence, and modern science is coming to bear upon the wisdom traditions that say, you know, love, take care of each other and love one another. But Michael, do you want to say something about the science? I know that this is your area of specialty.
Well, everybody's got to have an area of specialty. Yeah, Mary made reference to the fact that there's kind of a psychological shift that happens when a third party shows up and expresses care and value and affection for a potential victim, because the victimizer has dehumanized that victim. And in his or her own eyes, that victim is almost a non-person and something that you want to get rid of. And when somebody comes in who has a different attitude altogether toward that person who values them, your mind shifts. And we know that today there is an actual neurological mechanism for this. It's called mirror neurons. It turns out that when you see another person's attitude or their gestures or hear their words, neurons in your central nervous system, in your brain, will fire off and imitate exactly the response or the attitude of the person that you're seeing. Mm. Now, it doesn't mean that you will imitate them necessarily, but it does mean that we now have a physical explanation for part of this amazing effect of nonviolence, where if you can master your own anger and fear, it helps other people to diminish theirs.
It seems too, Michael, that it's more than... I want to emphasize that these peace team members have to go through a lot of discipline, because most of the people who are joining are not going to be people who are targeting minority communities. So they must also feel a sense of anger, a sense of injustice that people would do this, that people are making trouble for other people in the world with violent means, and that they have to work on this themselves, of looking at people who are threatening violence against their highest values, and not to belittle or judge them, but to say, you know, this isn't working for you either. We want to give you a way out, and I'm going to do so by asking, oh, it looks like you're circling around this church where the refugees and immigrants are staying. In your mind, you're thinking this is something to watch out for, and you go up to a truck of potentially armed people and say, it looks like you might be lost. Are you looking for directions? Are you looking for a store? Is there anything I can do for you? Playing it so simple, and yet it's such an effective technique.
Yeah, there are famous instances, actually, of peace team members jumping in to defend people whose values they completely abhor.
That's the power of it, isn't it? There's a lot of stories of, you know, like the woman in Michigan at a KKK rally, a woman of color, throwing her body on top of a KKK member who was getting ready to be attacked by anti-KKK protesters.
Yes, and Mary told us a stunning story about a person who had these hate tattoos all over him, and he was jumped by a very angry crowd, people who don't like racists can be as angry as the racists themselves. And they actually, I hate to say this, they hit him over the head with a bottle. He collapsed to the ground, and peace team members rushed in and walked him over to an ambulance. And he couldn't speak, but one of the peace team members said to him, just as he was getting in the ambulance, you know, I just want you to know that a gay Jewish person, a communist, and a Muslim saved your life just now. And this young man, of course, couldn't speak, but his girlfriend kind of broke down and said, you know, I have hated you people all my life, but now I see you have the same blood running in your veins that we do.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the importance of nonpartisanship in peace team work, whether it's on this scale, you know, local, or whether it's blown up to what we call unarmed civilian peacekeeping going on in South Sudan or Mindanao. And that's part of that must be, as you were saying, Stephanie, that must be the hardest part, to really be nonpartisan and to remind yourself at every moment that you're there for peace. You're there to create a space for dialogue. You are not part of the dialogue itself.
Right. There's another theory that everybody's heard of, fight or flight, that we get into when we're driving. We're in fight or flight. That's why there's Mr. Walker and Mr.
Wheeler.
Mr. Wheeler, you know, Mr. Walker is your neighbor. He's like, hey there, how's it going? And when he's behind the wheel, he's like running people down and following them on their bumpers, which we get a lot coming out to the radio station. That's fight or flight, and we know about it. And when we're in a situation where we're scared, that's what happens for us. We want to do something, and we don't have control of that anger, or we run away from it or avoid it. But there's another form of research out there that's pointing to another response, which is called tend and befriend. And that's really what peace teams are doing. They are pulling people together and looking for something in common, something possible. Now, Mary also really emphasizes that in the situation where you're just de-escalating, you're getting people away from each other, you're trying to get them, redirect them, whatever you can do, you're not there to try to convince anybody of a different way of viewing things, but that simply that you stop them from using violence in a situation, because our full humanity really doesn't want that violence, because it affects us when we use it so deeply, that by being able to stand in their way of that, that over time can reach somebody. But it's not, you're not going to, you know, somebody's attacking somebody, you're not going to get them to say, you know what, he is a human being, I'm walking away. So I hope that it's not giving you that kind of impression from this work. It's going to be the same in bystander intervention too. You're not going to argue with somebody and change their mind about what they're saying or what they're doing, but you will get them away, and they'll appreciate that, you know, they didn't get arrested for a violent act that they were capable of doing, you know, and that with time can help them to see their full humanity as well and get them to stop doing these things.
You know, there's a famous hadith about the Prophet Muhammad that he said, you must defend everyone. And his followers said, well, surely you mean we must defend
our friends.
Our
right?
friends, yeah. not we don't gonna, we're not going to defend an oppressor.
Right. They don't need defense.
And the Prophet, peace be upon him, said, no, I mean you defend everyone.
Mm-hmm.
So they said, well, how do we help an oppressor? And he said, by preventing them from oppressing.
Mm-hmm. So let's look at how that relates from the skills and the work of somebody very, very highly trained who's been at this for over 20 years, getting in the way of violence happening in very tough situations. And what she says about what we can learn from this work for violence that we see around us in this escalating tensions of violence toward people of color, toward people who are expressing other than Christian views of religion and so forth in this country and beyond.
There's a long list of skills that we try and teach them to de-escalate potentially violent situations. And we reference Maslow's quote of, if the only tool in your toolbox is a hammer, then every problem looks like a nail. So our job is to put as many tools into that toolbox as we can so that you feel like you've got something to reach for when you're in a situation that looks like violence could erupt. What's interesting is that, especially after the election, we had a lot more people aware of people being targeted, especially people of the Muslim faith, people of Hispanic heritage, and wanting to do something. When we know there's a rally, or we know that there's a big protest, or we're invited to something that looks like there's a potential flashpoint for violence, MPT can pull together a team. But what happens when you're just out on the street and it's just you, or you and your friend, or you and your spouse? What do you do when you see somebody being harassed? And so because a lot of the skills that we also teach for peace teams apply to what to do by yourself, we've been having more and more people request bystander intervention. We can give you tips and ideas and thoughts, but always know that if the first thing that you try doesn't work, reach back into the toolbox, grab something else. Because if we really see ourselves as one human family, then our brothers and sisters are really kind of depending on us at this point. What we're talking about is stopping violence with nonviolence, which statistically has been much more successful over time than any form of violence ever has been. And so we're talking about not adding fuel to a fire. And when you add violence towards violence, it escalates. But if you do something like move close to the person that's being harassed and make eye contact with them and let them know they're not alone. ask them, are you okay? Do you need help? Be willing to sit with them. Say, I won't leave you until you're safe. Be willing to ask other people, all right, let's surround this person and keep them safe. Doing things like if you are afraid that you are going to be really physically assaulted by a gang of people perpetrating this kind of harassment, start chanting, stop it now, stop it now. Get other people. Use your cameras. Document it. Many people who are committing these kind of real hate crimes don't want to have their crimes documented, and they'll leave. Don't engage in debates with them. You're not going to change their minds in this short period of time. Your responsibility is to the person being targeted. And so you take your lead from them. And so if they need protective accompaniment, i.e. people going with them to the bus stop so that they're safe, or to the grocery store so that they're safe, you can't ask for a better ally. Don't assume that the person isn't able to handle it themselves. Ask them, is there something I can do? Do you want me to stay with you? How can I help? They might not know the answers, and if they don't know the answers, don't leave them. And I think the most important part, is there a chance that this person is still going to be injured? Yep. Is there a chance that you might be injured? Yep. But if you're that person and you're physically hurt and you know there's witnesses all around and no one tried to stop it and no one stepped forward, that pain is greater than if you are injured in this to the same physical degree, but people were trying to stand with you and block those punches.
That was Mary Hanna from the META Peace Team talking about bystander intervention and what we can do to help people when we see violence happening around. And she also informed us a bit about the work of the META Peace Team and what they do. So you're listening to Nonviolence Radio, and we're here at our mother station, KWMR. Let's take a short break.
That pervades everything. It transcends the senses. While everything around me is ever changing, ever dying, there is a living power that is changeless, that holds all together, that creates, dissolves, and recreates.
Ishwari Allah, tero naam, sabko sammati de bhagwan. Ishwari Allah.
When peace breaks out, nothing but silence. From the mainstream media show, we want to know about nonviolence. Where do we go? Nonviolence Radio. Tell your friend, tell your foe.
Ooh, nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Nonviolence.
Challenging
radio.
Silence.
Ooh, nonviolence radio.
Challenging silence.
Greetings again, everyone. This is Michael Nagler with the news segment of Nonviolence Radio. As usual, I'm having two reflections. One, that there's so much I won't be able to fit it all in. I'll do the best I can. And two, talking about the resources today for learning nonviolence reminds me of what I had to do way back in the 60s and 70s when I was starting to learn about nonviolence. Yes, I know I don't look that old, but I was. And there was so little available, and now the resources are just pouring out, gratefully. There are three books, for example, actually four. One is called The Palestinian Checklist by Stephen Brinkley, and that's available as a free PDF download. And it describes what people can do short of actually going to Palestine. A second is by Terence Ryan, R-Y-N-N-E, and that book is called Gandhi and Jesus, The Saving Power of Nonviolence. There'll be a Q&A with Terry on the Pace Bene series this Thursday, the 29th, at 8 Eastern, 5 p.m. our time. Marcos Militzos of Daily Kos has written something called The Resistance Handbook, 45 Ways to Fight Trump. And that brings in the fourth book I wanted to mention. It's by Naomi Klein, and it's called No is Not Enough. And that is an important dialogue that's going on right now in the, quote, resistance movement, that to what extent should it be dictated by the Trump agenda, and to what extent should it be positive actions coming from ourselves? I'm very much in that second camp. The ICNC, the International Center for Nonviolent Conflict, is just amazing in its prolific resourcefulness, and they have a new blog called Minds of the Movement. It's about the people and power of civil resistance. It aims to be a go-to source for all readers to find interesting ideas, analysis, commentary, research findings, and the folks working in this field. Sounds a little bit like Nonviolence Radio, actually. And along with their Nonviolence News Hub, a Nonviolent Conflict News site, there was an important blog by Steve Chase, who was countering an article by Ben Case in Roar, R-O-A-R, who put forward a classic kind of diversity of tactic argument. And Chase cites Omar Wasso, Do Protests Matter? That's really recommended reading. Now, if you remember the animal rights era when people were going around trashing laboratories, it was pointed out, I think by Peter Singer in one of his books on animal rights, that the worst thing you can do is to trash a laboratory, because then the violence becomes the issue and all sense of whether animal rights was the issue is lost. So very similarly, Wasso discovered that proximity to disciplined mass nonviolent protests kept, in this case, the white people focused on the issue of civil rights, whereas a proximity to violent protests shifted their focus to law and order. It's exactly the same dynamic. But both of these people actually missed an article in Mobilization back in 2015 by Kurt Schock and Erica Chenoweth, which was about the inutility of what they call the radical flank, in other words, the diversity of tactics. One other resource, I know it's coming up later, but I want to mention it now. On October 2nd, Gandhi's birthday, the 7th annual free course, year-long course, is being offered by Gujarat Vidyapeeth. It's free if you get there. The course is called Gandhian Nonviolence Theory and Applications, and they take you all over northern India to Gandhian institutions. Now, on to the news. I'm starting off with something that might be really big. It's a potentially game-changing development, and we will be watching it closely here on Nonviolence Radio. It's where the religious left is rousing itself to break the monopoly of the dogmatic right. That's my vocabulary. But remember Michael Lerner's book, The Left Hand of God. People are calling this a battle for the soul of faith. And I have no doubt that, directly or indirectly, Pope Francis and the Catholic Nonviolence Initiative have played a supportive role in this development. And, of course, our own North Carolina Reverend Barber is a prominent force in this movement. Just think what a tremendous difference it could make if the moral high ground was no longer occupied by people who are saying that abortion is the only evil and so forth. Well, we'll be watching this closely in the weeks to come. Along this line, kind of, the Campaign Nonviolence, which is basically a religious organization in its founding impulse, plans to ramp up after this year's September Week of Actions to really build up to the following year, 2018, because that week in September will be shortly before the midterm congressional elections. They say that their goal is, quote, "This will not be a narrow electoral strategy focused on specific candidates, but a coordinated action plan to frame the midterm vote as a referendum on a nonviolent future. As the author of a book called Search for a Nonviolent Future, I was thrilled to see this development. So look to CNV, Campaign Nonviolence, for further on that. A quick update on the nuclear ban, which is moving forward in the United Nations. The deadline for signing the document is coming soon. It'll be July 7th. The pace of disarmament was a critical point of contention in the earlier meetings, but that seems to have been resolved. And Beatrice Finn, F-I-H-N, the executive director of the International Campaign to Abolish Nuclear Weapons, said something back in May that is quite pertinent still today. Quote, almost all the nuclear-armed states, you know who you are, put pressure on smaller countries to not participate, not attend, and there will be more pressure when time for signing the treaty comes, which is almost upon us. But here's the important thing. She goes on to say, it's not going to get easier for us, but it's not going to get any easier for them to ignore the treaty either. It's moving forward whether or not they like it. That is a nonviolent spirit. Recently, there was a Ban the Bomb rally in San Francisco to go supporting this. It was on the 17th here in San Francisco at the UN Plaza. So I want to tell you about a very nice movement that I'm feeling, again, very encouraged by. It's called the Sunrise Movement. It was founded by 8 college students, and they're focusing on climate issues. They say, Sunrise is an army of young people to stop climate change and create millions of good-paying jobs in the process. Now, you may remember the German Greens, who were so effective under the leadership of Petra Kelly back in the 70s. Petra used to say, wir sind weder da links noch rechts, wir sind da vorne, which means we are neither right nor left, we are out ahead. And guess what? The Sunrise Movement is now saying, and I quote, we are not looking to the right or left, we look forward. So they're aiming to change this country and this world, sure as the sun rises each morning. That's where they get their logo. Now, interestingly, they say, and this is a good example of how nonviolence learning, it helps shape movements and make them more effective. They say, quote, we're not leaving behind the legacy of nonviolent protest that has won so many things. Marches, demonstrations, and sit-ins will be a part of the plan, but so will knocking on doors and recruiting candidates. And they avow that they've been influenced by Paul and Mark Engler's book, This is an Uprising. Needless to say, being college students, they have a very pretty logo and a really nice website. Recently, in Truth Out, there was an article by an environmental activist, Ted Hamilton, reporting on the following development. A group of climate activists were tried in district courts in Mount Vernon, Washington, and Wauwijanda, New York, for committing acts of civil disobedience against fossil fuel infrastructure. Now, the defendants, there were 8 of them in both cases, tried to present what they called a climate necessity defense. So if you remember, back in the 80s and 90s when people were attacking the nose cones of nuclear missiles and so forth, they argued that it was a necessary defense because the lawlessness and potential harm of the objects that they were attacking was far more serious than the harm that they were doing. So they were, by kind of natural right, called upon to do this. And in many cases, the judges did admit that a necessary defense. However, carrying forward on that defense now did not work, and the judges weren't having any, even though the threat of climate catastrophe is a crime that is much more serious than just interfering with private property or corporate property. But they were all convicted on June 7th of charges of varying seriousness, though they are going to appeal. It's an interesting issue that they raise. It forces a kind of reevaluation of what we mean by legal, you know. What is natural law or dharma, and how should human law relate to it? And again, I see an interesting connection. It's just marvelous the way the same issues are coming up in all different parts of the Not Yet movement. I'm thinking of Chairman David Archambault II, who was the chair of the Standing Rock Sioux, who recently made this statement. Just because what they're doing is legally right, it's morally and ethically wrong. So it's that necessary defense argument there. And he goes on to say, there's a different point, but also very interesting for us. What happened at Standing Rock is a movement, and you don't see the benefits of a movement until way later. That relates to what I used to call work versus work and what I'm now tending to call more immediate results versus deep results. And when you do something nonviolent, it always has positive deep results, whether or not you gain what you immediately wanted. So we've commented before on the wonderful results of the Standing Rock uprising, protection, where so many people who've never been in touch before were collaborating. So you brought new demographics, new entities into the struggle. Well, I'd like to say more about that, but I think I better move on. Los Angeles. In the World War II, Los Angeles did a brilliant job of mobilizing and turning out hundreds of thousands of Angelenos to contribute to aircraft and ship manufacturing, to volunteer to aid the Red Cross by the tens of thousands. And now the mayor of Los Angeles is calling on all Angelenos to mobilize once again. But this time, they're mobilizing against climate destruction. And they've, of course, been stimulated by the announcement of the president's decision to withdraw the United States from the Paris Climate Accord earlier this month. Again, this is a silver lining and a very big one, because during the administration of Barack Obama, people thought to some degree of justification that the government would take care of things like this. It's now very clear that the government will not. And so power is devolving down to communities and cities, which I think is where it belonged in the first place. Now, Naomi Klein, to quote her again, and her, she has an organization called LEAP, which is the next version of the news story. She said, "This announcement by Los Angeles today is a remarkable development. If the city of Los Angeles listens to the voices of communities on the front lines and centers racial and economic justice the way it addresses climate change, this could be a historic leap with ripples around the world." One more very nice organization I'd like to share with us all. You may remember Adbusters. It was a Canadian magazine that set out to counteract, do some kind of cultural guerrilla warfare against the dominant power of corporate and commercial advertising. And Occupy, of course, wanted to do the same thing. But Adbusters directed its attention at advertising. That's why it got its name. And here we go again. We have now subvertisers, people who want to subvert the advertising culture. And there's a hashtag, Subvert the City, which is a campaign that replaced 500 corporate advertising panels back last March, working in 40 cities worldwide. Again, I simply can't emphasize enough what a tremendous difference that would make. If you combine that with the religious left getting into politics, you're really changing the culture.
I wonder how we know when we've seen a Subvert the City advertisement replacement.
Yeah, I guess take a look at that hashtag and be directed to some of the photos. They're really wonderful. They've chosen mottos that are uplifting but not inflammatory. So just two really quick things from around the world. The Japanese Diet, their parliament, voted in a bill which has been having a chilling effect on Japanese people because it's very similar to a bill that suppressed dissent leading up to World War II. And the demonstrations have been very big. There is an attempt by President Abe to revise the Japanese Constitution. Now, he says he's going to keep Article 9, but recognize the armed forces. I want to say two things very quickly about that. The Japanese Constitution, and Article 9 in particular, was not a constitution of their own making. It was forced on them by the American occupation. I'm not saying it was a bad idea, but you cannot give people peace consciousness from the outside. Also, the Article 9 simply says the Japanese military will not go to war on foreign soil. It doesn't say what they will use as an alternative to protect themselves. And one last quick thing, if I may, the Rojava region in Syria, which has been held down by a colonial dynamic of its own central government for years. It's a wheat-growing and very important commercial area, has organized itself into cooperatives that are spreading to other regions. They aim to supplant the capitalist economy through a communal economy, just as the revolution is trying to make the state redundant by organizing the community in communes that bring everyone into positions of power.
Thank you very much, Michael Nagler, for that exciting edition of Nonviolence in the News. And we want to also think about Mary Hanna, who was our first interview of the day, explaining the work of Meta Peace Team and how we can use skills from third-party nonviolent intervention as bystanders and when we see violence happening around us. Now, Maria Montessori, quoted by Gandhi, was said, if we want nonviolence in the world, we have to start with the children. So here to end the show today is a friend of mine from Petaluma who's sharing what a new little show that she created at our office at the Meta Center for Nonviolence, and I thought you might enjoy it, everyone.
My name is Amber, and I'm a host. And here's my two hosts.
Hello.
Hello. Annabelle, what's our show?
Sparkles.
And what do we talk about on Sparkles?
Something I know about Sparkles. They're on a dress, and I love Sparkles on dresses.
I love sparkles, too, especially the sparkles that I see in the sky at night that are stars. What about you, Charlie?
Well, I mostly like the stars the best because they are natural sparklers.
I hope you enjoy the show. I love the show, too.
I'm not doing it.